So Ethan prayed, among other things, that you and we would be attentive to the things that Lee says. And that means that if I say something wrong,
we're still going to be attentive.
You have to be attentive and point it out to me, because that is the only way we will be able to help each other, if we're keeping each other on our toes. But I appreciate the prayer. So, who among us tonight doesn't have any problems? Obviously, the Bosworths have some problems. Anybody? Nobody has no problems? Wow, what a sorry group we are. Who among us has a Goliath of a problem? What do I mean by that? Now, I see two hands. A huge problem. I'll tell you, I've got a Goliath of a problem, if not one. And when I say a problem, I mean external or internal. What I mean by external is this. External challenges. For example, being faithful despite a broken body. That's, the broken body you can't help unless you went out and stood in the street, and then you could have helped that. But here we have to live a faithful life with a body that's broken. That's an external challenge. How do we deal with that, right? Here's another, and you think of some of your own, some of that I haven't mentioned. Providing for our family, we're supposed to provide, especially married men, to provide for our family tonight, despite not having a quote-unquote good job, whatever that means. But some of us don't have any jobs at all. Some people don't have any jobs. That's a Goliath problem, because we are told to provide for ourselves. Maintaining faith despite unbelieving or unfaithful family. That is huge. I mean, that's just a mountain. That's bigger than Goliath. That's a mountain of a problem. Maintaining a role despite a husband or wife not fulfilling their role. That can be a mountain of a problem. And other things like that. Anybody else, external challenges? Anybody here got a problem that you want to confess to? How about internal problems, personality, character challenges? Here's my biggie, impatience. Whoops, I don't know what just happened. That's a Goliath one for me, if not a Mount Everest. I don't know how to qualify. Maybe a trip to one astronomical unit for me. Anybody? Personal challenges? Maybe you can identify somebody else's? Lusting? It's a challenge. Being distracted by fire or ambulance sirens as they go by? Swearing? Some folks are... A friend of ours in Rhode Island, when we were visiting last week, said that he's immersed in the culture of swearing, and he's tempted to do it. This is a strong, faithful guy, and here he's got this temptation. Complaining, submitting, or, on the other hand, leading. Some men just won't lead. Some women just won't submit. Some children won't submit. Some of us won't submit to the government. Envying, etc. Anybody else? Another problem that I haven't mentioned? Gary?
Self-examination.
Refuse to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a problem.
Right.
It's easier to see your faults than mine.
I think it's easier to see yours than mine.
See?
Anybody else? I mean, it doesn't matter. I don't know what yours is. I know what some of mine are. I don't even know what all of mine are. These are some pretty big things. Yeah?
I'm just going to say, a lot of those can be lumped into one word, pride.
Pride. Didn't even have it up there. Didn't even think of it. Maybe because that's my blind side. Pride. Wow. Aren't I something? These are all things that we have to overcome. So the question is, how? How can we overcome these Goliath issues? And if I don't talk about this, then I'll have completely missed an entire chapter from 1 Samuel. which I would prefer not to do. Who else had a Goliath of a problem? Thank you.
Israel. Saul.
Right. Israel. I just hear what you said. Yeah, Saul. When David had his Goliath of a problem, how did he overcome it? Sorry?
With God's help.
With God's help. Do you notice how many times, I know it's been a few weeks since you read chapter 17, 1 Samuel 17, but in his explanation, when he comes up to Saul, Saul says to him, "You can't do it. You're not able." Verse 33. You're unable. Verse 34. David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep. A lion and a bear came out and took a lamb from the flock. I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. When he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God." Verse 37, and David said, "The Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me." If you follow Lord or God or he or anything like that, in this chapter alone, David will say it 10 times. God, 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 God. When the Philistine comes out, "I'm going to give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field." David says, verse 45, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of the hosts." Here's this little wee little guy coming out against this giant. We didn't even read all that. This comes out against Goliath, yet he wins. How? With God's help. He put his trust. He knew. God's going to do it for me. God's going to do it. So, if you have a problem that you need to overcome, trust in God. That's the story. That's the point of the story. It doesn't matter if it's a real Goliath or a figurative Goliath. If you got a problem, overcome. Now, did David trust in God? Yes. Is that all he did?
No.
What did he do next?
Acted.
He took the first step, didn't he? He starts putting on... Right. We have to act also. The actual step towards overcoming the obstacles. A lot of us, me, myself included, I trust God, but when it comes to dealing with the problem, you know what I never do? Take that first step. Put my money where my mouth is, right? By the way, did you notice, had David ever killed a Goliath before? No, has he ever gone to battle before? This is something that, as far as we know, he had never done. That's what we call a leap of faith, isn't it?
Yeah, the lion, probably not easy.
No, right. Obviously, that's the point, right? But here's this new thing. Here's this new area in his life, you know, and he's not just, I've done it over there, I've done it over there, but when it comes to this, oh man, he's never done this one thing. He's done something like it. He's never done this one thing. And what does he say? "I'm just going to trust God, and I'm going to put my right foot, and then my left foot, and my right foot, and that's how I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to do it." And that's how we have to overcome.
I think there's evidence in here of him remembering small victories.
Yes.
And that's something that I would hope all of us could look back where
right.
we came from and say, I'm still in that same spot, but maybe not made as much progress as I would like, but I have made a lot of progress.
Right. Like James, consider it all joy when different trials get thrown at you, because it produces endurance. But just the trial being thrown at you doesn't produce endurance. Putting your right foot down, a little one, and a little one, and a bigger one, and a bigger one, and a bigger one, and next thing you know, you're a spiritual Goliath, or David, however you want to look at it. Try an unconventional approach. David puts on his sword and his armor, and he tried to walk, and he said, "Get rid of this stuff." The point being, if he goes out there with all that stuff, it somewhat diminishes the fact that God is the one in charge here. Here's this little pebble comes, whacks him in the head. Oh, God's doing that. It's clearer to see. Unconventional, what I mean by that is, people will look around, and you have a problem, and they'll say, "Oh, you need to try this drug, or you need to go talk to this shrink, or you need to do this," or whatever it might be. Unconventional as far as the world thinks. Try God. That's unconventional if you ask the world, right? And then Something else is here. I know there's something here. Expect naysayers. Saul says, you can't do it. You can't do it. His brothers earlier in the story had said, you can't, you know, what are you doing here? You're just trying to be a little stinker is what you're trying to be. Comments or questions on that?
It's interesting to see how his recounting the lion and the bear issue seems to show that he had a good attitude about taking those situations, but he couldn't necessarily prove God put in front of him to prepare him for this. But that was somewhat irrelevant. He was going to behave as though they had. You know, and that we're exactly in the same situation all the time. I get asked, well, if you don't believe miracles take place today, do you believe God works today? Yes, I do. Well, prove what is it? Well, no, I'm just going to assume it's all from God and act on that instead. And that's exactly what's happening here.
Right, right. Good point.
None of us know what God is putting in front of us and what just happens to life. No.
Right. It is life. Everybody's life. There's nothing new. I talked about this last week. Jehovah. God could use... God proved himself here. We talked about that last week. Over. God can use everyone. Everyone. What was David before he killed Goliath? A shepherd. In this chapter alone, he's a shepherd. He's a gopher. What's a gopher? Yeah, go do this, go do that, and he's a messenger boy. And don't get smaller on the totem pole than the messenger boy and the shepherd, but yet he's the one God used. Now, let me ask you a question real quick. Well, let's not miss this. You know, so you might not have the maturity of one of the older brethren here at the congregation. Don't assume that you can't do anything then. You might not have the ability of that song leader gets up and hits the note every single time and's got his hand doing this the right way. But don't assume that you can't do something. You might not be able to do that exactly. Remember 1 Corinthians chapter 12, is it? You know, there's a role for all of us. God put us all there. You do what you're good at, develop what you're not, and never think that you can't do anything. At the same time here, wouldn't it be great if this congregation had a David move in? A David, a slayer of giants, come here. I'll just throw out Sewell Hall. I don't know who. Maybe you got your Sewell Hall. I mean, fantastic. That would be great, wouldn't it? What about the David moves here that's not quite killed the giant yet and is just only a little messenger boy right now? Is there anything wrong with that? No, because you never know what that David's going to become, do you? Somebody comes in the door. Yes, great. Hey, Sewell Hall or Sewell Hall 50, 60, 70 years ago. Right?
Oh, I was just going to say, whether Sewell Hall or Dale Smelser or whoever you want to put on there, They didn't start out as a spiritual Goliath, if you will. They started out probably as somebody lower, and they just started going. Another thing I was gonna say, you said David wasn't the lowest on the totem pole, but yet God, a couple chapters ago, had anointed him king.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't matter to God.
Right. God knew his heart. He's a man after God's own heart. Here's another one. Think outside the box. Two things about this. First of all, learn to see the world for what it is. When David was out there fighting against Goliath, what was he saying? It's God. Jehovah God. Jehovah God is, like you said earlier, you know, God's doing it all. We assume God's doing it all. Whatever. Learn to see the world. We're living in a spiritual world. That's the kind of world we have to view. At the same time, in verse 25 of this chapter, the men of Israel said to David, "Have you seen this man who's coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel. And it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches, and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free, probably, of taxes in all Israel." Wow, I'll take it. And what does David say? If you remember, I know it's been a few weeks. Verse 26, David spoke to the men who were standing him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine who takes away the reproach from Israel. That is what is on David's mind. Yeah, all these great riches, that would be fantastic, whatever, but here's the real deal. He's looking at things totally different than everybody else. Everybody else is like, oh, I'll take all this, good, that'll be fantastic, and they won't even act on it because it's not worth it to them. But David looks at things, this is a spiritual situation we're living in, and this is the difference between, or should be the difference between us and the world. They're looking at the new material thing for this year that's going to change by a month down the road. As soon as you drive off the lot, it's worth $5,000 less. We're supposed to be looking at things spiritually. Always look for opportunity. He went there looking to see the welfare of his brothers and what was going on. And he turned it into, oh, I can do something for God here. You know, you might be going to laundry at the laundromat. You might be going for groceries in the grocery store. You might be going to the John Deere dealership to buy a new John Deere, whatever the case might be. But always look for those opportunities. God is always looking for us, so we need to always be looking for others. Comments or questions here? Okay. Good. No. We're just kind of go. What's your point?
I just, the part about this that, just kind of a chronological thing always interested me. Saul didn't have any idea who David was.
Okay.
That's kind of odd.
That's next to deal with.
Great.
Okay. All right. Right. So what?
Assuming we're in chronological order.
Right. Okay. Actually. Okay. What you said is, sorry to jump all over you. What you said is, Saul didn't know what? Who David was.
Yeah.
To be technical, that's not what he asks. Okay? All right, so let's start over in 1 Samuel 16, verse 14. The Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. An evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him. Saul's servant said to him, behold, now an evil spirit from God is terrorizing you. 16:16. Let our Lord now command your servants who are before you. Let them seek a man who is a skillful player on the harp. And it will come about when the evil spirit from God is on you that he shall play the harp with his hand and you will be well. So Saul said to his servants, provide for me a man. Verse 18, one of them said, behold, I have seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is a skillful musician, a mighty man of valor, a warrior, one prudent in speech, and a handsome man, and the Lord is with him. And Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, send me your son, David, who is with the flock. Jesse took a donkey, loaded it with bread, and a jug of wine, and a young goat, and sent them to Saul by David, his son. David came to Saul and attended him, and Saul loved him greatly, and he became his armor-bearer. Saul sent to Jesse, let David now stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight. Okay, that's all we need to read for now. The question here, I'm going to ask two questions. The first question is, and I'll answer the first one. The first question is, how well does Saul know David here? And I'm going to say, it doesn't really matter, but I'll say reasonably well. I'm going with reasonably well. He obviously doesn't know everything about him. Okay. All right. The thing about the armor bearer, let me get back to it. I can say it now. David's captain of the army, now had how many armor bearers? 10. Joab had 10 armor bearers, and he's the captain of the army. How many did David have? I don't know, but I'm guessing more than 10. If the captain of the army has 10, then the king, who is just as much out there with them all the time, probably has more. I don't know. So my point is that an armor bearer is not necessarily the only one. In fact, in chapter 17, when they're out to war, where is David, the armor bearer? He's not there. So it may have been more of a honorary type. It may have been. I can't say it for sure. I don't know. But I know Joab had 10. That's in somewhere. Yeah, I'll get it to you later. I've taken those notes and chucked them. Or it's in 2 Samuel 18:15. 2 Samuel 18:15. Joab had 10. Okay. While you're looking that up. So what we have in chapter 16 is that David, Saul knows David, but here's the second question. How well do you think, from this chapter, Saul knows David's father? Not very well. Chapter 17, just remember that, not very well. All right, chapter 17, David goes out, kills this Goliath. Verse 55, when Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this young man?" And Abner said, "By your life, I do not know." The king said, "Inquire whose son the youth is." So when David returned killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand. That ought to have been interesting. Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David said, "I am the son of your servant Jesse the Bethlehemite." So to be clear, Saul is not asking, "Who are you?" So if anybody ever said he doesn't know who David is, that's not what he's saying. The question is, whose son are you? Now, before chapter 17, what was David to Saul primarily?
A servant,
and specifically, what did he do? What was his main role? Play a harp. I think he just learned something about his harpist. His harpist is a man who can go out and lead an entire army and kill somebody who nobody else would kill. He's learning something about David here. Now, chapter 14, verse 52. The war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. When Saul saw any mighty man or valiant man, he attached him to his staff. Before chapter 17, David was not attached to the staff the same way he would become attached to the staff after chapter 17. Okay? Now, listen. He says in chapter 17, the question is, whose son are you? Whose son are you? Whose son are you? And he says, "I am David the son..." He doesn't even say his name. "I am the son of your servant Jesse the Bethlehemite." Now look in verse 18, verse 1. "It came about when he had finished speaking to Saul, that Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself." Here's the question. Does that sound like he said the conversation? Does that sound like this is the entire conversation? "Whose son are you?" "I am the son of Jesse." Done? It doesn't sound that way to me either. It sounds like, "Whose son are you?" "I'm the son of David, I'm the son of Jesse the Bethlehemite." When it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul, they all hugged. Jonathan was hugging and everything was... The point being, I can't prove anything for sure, but it does sure seem like this is totally different than, "Who is David? I don't know who that man is." That's not the question he asks. Number two, even when he asks, "Who is his father?" Although he already knew the guy's name, maybe, from chapter 16, when he's done with this, he's asking a totally different question. It's not, "Who is your father?" but, "Tell me about your family. I collect valiant men. I've just identified you as one. Are there any more of you?" That's all I got for you. There's nothing certain, but take your time, and I think it'll become plausible to you. In which case, if it is plausible, then there certainly is no contradiction. Okay?
Is that what the point is?
Yes.
Contradiction. Okay, I was trying to...
I wasn't making that point.
Oh, I know. I know you wouldn't. But, you know, I can point to a dozen places that would make that. All right. So you did, you studied chapters 19 through 24. I've sent those questions like 5 times. I've already received one complaint about my questions, so I'm not even going to bother to ask them. In fact, I didn't even like them myself. But all right. So before, in chapter 18, Saul takes David, and then he starts sending him out over men of war, verse 5. And it was pleasing in the sight of all the people. And then the women start to sing, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s, and Saul became very angry for this saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000, but to me they have ascribed thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? And Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day. He tries to kill him in verse 10 with a spear in his hand. And then he tries to scheme through marrying his daughter. Somehow the Philistines will end up killing him. Verse 29 of chapter 18, Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus, Saul was David's enemy continually. And that is the rest of this book. That's the whole story of the rest of this book, which you read half of that story in preparation for tonight. So we're going to look at Saul rather topically right now. Saul's sickness. There are some symptoms that are of Saul's sickness. He was sick, and here are the symptoms. It begins with, Saul looked at David with suspicion. Do you remember in the New Testament that love... Okay, casts out fear. That's not the one I was thinking of, but that's right. Believes all things, that's what popped into my mind. Love hopes all things. He ain't hoping all things or believing all things. Here, can you turn on the back... thing there. Both top and bottom button. Thank you. Okay, so he looked at David with suspicion. We're off to a bad start already. He tried to kill David in 1811. He schemed to have David killed with two of his daughters. He went against reason. Jonathan says, why are you trying to kill him? He's a good man. He hasn't sinned against you. And Saul says, oh, that's a good idea. But then afterwards he goes back against them. He went against his own family, his son and his daughter in chapter 19 and chapter 18. And then he went against God in chapter 19. Remember, Saul sends out his messengers and they start prophesying, and then Saul goes down himself and they start prophesying. And the point is, look, stop what you're doing. It's a different scenario, but the same idea is with Balaam and the ox. Stop what you're doing is the point with the, not an ox, a donkey, right? Right. Yeah, kicking. He tried to murder his own son. He falsely accused his own people of supporting David. You read that. That's right before he goes and slaughters against, has the priests of Nob slaughtered. Went against his own people. They would. He said, slaughter them. And they wouldn't do it. So he had to go and get an Edomite. So he has this partnership with a non-Israelite. By the way, while he's partnering with a non-Israelite, he's driving a man after God's own heart away. Right? He murdered a priest and an entire town of priests and their families. More about that in a little while. Knew that what he was doing is wrong. He knows it. He neglected his work in protecting the kingdom for pursuing David. What I mean by this is, do you remember when David inquired of the Lord if he should go down and deliver Keilah or Keilah? That's the king's job. Here come the Philistines. They get the Keilahites, or whatever you pronounce that. And David says, should I go do it? Because Saul's not doing it. Okay? And then, finally, he sought David. It says, almost the end of our reading, every day. He sought David every day. So I want you to diagnose this guy Saul, his sickness. Diagnose it. And we'll come up with things that are different, but I'm sure that we'll all agree on each one. Pride. He's got pride. No love. Sorry, somebody said something? Envy. Envy? Envy. Envy. That's three. I can't do three. Envy.
He's being controlled by his emotions, not controlling.
He's being controlled by his emotions, not controlling.
He's letting himself be controlled by his emotions.
Letting himself.
I mean, each of us can control our emotions. You know, it's not
right. Right. Otherwise, yeah.
Right.
We have a. We each of us can control our. He's letting us. Anybody? Anything else? I mean, you know, we could go on for a long time here.
Not following God.
Okay, let me suggest this. Is he rebellious? Okay, but this is more than rebellion. Because, let's take this one. He falsely accused his own people of supporting David. If he went on doing that, that would be rebellion all by itself. That one thing. If he repented of that, of this one thing, then he would not be any longer rebellious in this one area. What I'm saying here is this. This is more than rebellion. He's got a list. I mean, there's just the rap sheet, that's what we call it, right? He's got a whole rap sheet against it. He went on pursuing David every day. He begins with, he looked on him with suspicion continually. That's what I'm getting at. He is obsessed. He is totally obsessed. All those other things are absolutely true, and so is this. This man is obsessed. We have OCD. He is obsessed, and if you change the C to a hard C, with killing David. OCD. Okay? What, you want to say something? Yeah. Sorry. Shouldn't have said that, huh? It'll come back to you. So, he's obsessed. This is more than rebellion. It's obsession. And look where... This is the whole point. Does it matter what you're obsessed with? Not really. Right? This is where obsession will take you. Saul, would you ever do this?
Halfway down you will. The list, I mean once you get halfway down the progression here, you will ultimately end up at the bottom.
Yeah. Right. But way back in the beginning, Saul, are you not Saul? Are you nuts? Okay, you'll say no. I'm not nuts. But yet, this is where an obsession will take you. There's an expression, it's perfect. Sin takes you farther than you want to go, keeps you longer than you want to stay, and costs you more than you want to pay. And you have no control over it. You do have control over yourself. You don't have control over what sin will do to you.
Well, I remember, even in our own justice system here in America or wherever, he would be charged on top of other things, there are several counts of attempted murder. The amount of times he tried to kill his own family, kill David,
Right. And then he'd be let go for technical problems, right? You said envy back there. It all started, this whole thing started with, they were singing a song of praise to David, and he said, it's pretty much what he said. Envy is how it started. Do you remember what Pilate said about Jesus? They handed him over because of envy. Envy is nothing to play with. What is envy? What is jealousy? Envy and jealousy are a little bit different. Jealousy is, I want what you have. Envy is a little bit more.
You
want to
be what they are.
Yes. And?
Do anything,
and you don't want them to have it. Right. I want what you have, and I don't want you to have it. Envy.
Envy listed after anger in Ephesians.
Let's see. Is it in Ephesians?
Anger, doesn't lead to envy?
Yeah. It's either Ephesians or Galatians. I didn't include them all up here. From within the heart of men proceeds evil thoughts, fornications, thieves, murders, adulteries, deeds of coveting, wickedness, as well as deceit, sensuality, envy. Depraved mind. Envy is from a depraved mind. This is not like, oh, it's okay, I can play around with envy. No. We were spending our life in malice, but he saved us. And so, no longer. Don't play with envy. Therefore, putting aside all malice and all deceit, hypocrisy, and envy, and all slander, like newborn babies long for the be pure, that's a footnote, pure milk from the word. So what's the prescription? He has a Goliath of a problem. Does that mean he can't overcome it? So what did we say earlier? Trust in God. Yeah. How does he repent? What leads to repentance? How does he start this repentance?
He steps away from what tempts him to do wrong.
Yes.
I mean, if he would have had the strength to say, whoever's knighted after me, or not knighted, but anointed, you know, time for me to get out of here for my own good.
Right. For the good of nation, because God wants it, and for my own good. There's something to be said here. Well, we'll get there in just a second. Okay. He was...
Well, you know, that's the thing. You know, you realize you're doing wrong. Okay? And then as you go along, then you have a thought. Stop. Check that thought.
Mm-hmm.
Check it. Because if you let yourself run with that thought, you don't control it, you're back on this path again.
Yes. So, instead of... control. Let's stick with this word control. Something was controlling Saul. What was not? What was he not allowing to control him? So what was controlling him? Okay, yes. And what I was thinking of initially is himself, his own will. Did go ahead?
It's not in us to guide our steps.
Right. Did Jesus have a will of his own? Did that will of his own sometimes not exactly 100% agree with God's will? And so what did he do? He prayed. Let your will be done, not my will. So, pray, and then study, meditation, and application. That's Galatians 5. These are the deeds of the flesh, and these are the deeds of the spirit. And you can't do them both at the same time. It's impossible to do them both. So if you find yourself doing one of these, all you have to do, I say it like it's easy, all you have to do is stop doing that. And if nothing else, go do something kind. Something kind to somebody else. That's easy to do compared to some of the other things. Just stop what you're thinking, stop what you're doing, and go pick up something that is kind. Application. And then time with godly people. In chapter 26, the second time, we haven't got there yet, but the second time David spares Saul, he asks him a question. Basically, his question is, if I'm innocent, let me go. If I'm guilty, don't let me go. But the way he words it is very interesting. Because it implies something about what's happening with Saul. Verse 19. Therefore, so this is 26:19. Please let my lord the king listen to the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. But if it is men... You see, it's one of two things, and it wasn't the Lord. So although all of this was in Saul, what was right there with him? A bunch of men saying, do it, Saul, do it, Saul, do it, Saul. Go get him, go get him, go get him. You know who we never... How many sons did Saul have? Do you remember? He has more than Jonathan. Do we ever hear of the others? No, other than the day that they die. I'm curious... I have no answer for this, never will. But whether or not there were some of the men saying, go, Daddy, go, Daddy, go. Get him, get him. George said earlier, part of the process is remove yourself from this temptation. That includes the people. And if you can remove yourself from those people, remember Hebrews chapter 3? Encourage one another day after day so that your heart won't be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. So that's insanely, very important, incredibly important to have the right people that you surround yourself by. Comments or questions here?
I think Romans 12 kind of sums this whole thing up, where it talks about, appeal to your brothers by the mercy of God to present your bodies a living sacrifice. This is an ongoing thing. This is not a one-time thing. It's a getting better at it. It's an improvement. A living sacrifice.
Yeah.
Not a one-time sacrifice.
Right.
And be transformed by the renewing.
Yeah. Yes.
On and on and on.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. It's one of the passages that I thought of and I said no. In Ephesians chapter 5. Do not be drunk with wine. Verse 18. Ephesians 5:18. Do not be drunk with wine, for that dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit. That sounds like this is what Saul needed. This is what we need when we're going through some struggles, when we're facing that Goliath or that little molehill, whatever it is, this is what we need. We need to be filled with the Spirit, okay? What does he say? How do we do that? Speaking to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord. There's more to it. That's not all, not just singing. But if you want to avoid all this stuff, what do? You get together with some other Christians and you sing. And that helps. There's more to it, but that's a big part of it. We have a singing coming up just in a few weeks.
And it goes on to say, submit to one
another. Right. Yeah, there's a whole... Verse 17, understand what the will of the Lord is. Study. Yeah, there's a whole litany of things. Okay. Yeah, we'll save that for next week. Okay, so here's another point. Thank God for the Jonathans in our lives. We're not studying much about Jonathan. At least we're not. We're reading about him. What is he, chapter 19, chapter 20, maybe 21, maybe I'm off by chapter. Then chapter 23 again, he's coming up. He's helping. You know, there was a time where, not here, where there was somebody that was, it seemed like this person was after me. It wasn't a healthy situation. And there was somebody else, Shane Gillespie. I know that some of you know him. Or at least one of you do. This guy was like a Jonathan for me. He was like, Lee, I understand what you're going through. I know the whole deal, and I'm with you, and I'm supportive of you. And that was huge for me. Absolutely huge. Where would we be without some Jonathans around? Thank God for Jonathans. And I hope that I am a Jonathan to somebody. At the same time, what about those people in those places who don't have access to a Jonathan? They're all alone. They're one Christian, like the Ethiopian eunuch down in Ethiopia to begin with. I assume that he converted somebody. I never know. But what about those people who don't have a Jonathan? What can we do? What can we do for those people far away? Paul says in 2 Corinthians 11:29 that apart from all these daily things where I was spent the night in the deep and all this, I was whipped three times, so on and so forth, there's the daily concern for the churches. Who is weak without my being weak? Now, it doesn't say prayer there. But how many times does he say, I've prayed for you. I pray, well, here's some of them. Unceasingly, I make mention of you in my prayer. This is just a couple of them. These aren't them all. This is what this man does. He's away from everybody. How many of these people does he write to and say, I can't wait to see you the next time I see you so that I can be a Jonathan to you and you can be a Jonathan to me? He says that over and over. And in the meantime, what is he doing while he can't be with them? Praying, 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 praying. Epaphras, who is one of your number, a bondslave of Jesus Christ, sends you his greetings, always laboring earnestly for you in his prayers. Do you need a work to do? Remember a few minutes ago we were saying, oh, maybe I can't lead songs the way that guy can lead songs. But you can go home and spend time in your closet just like anybody else can. Praying and praying and praying because we all need it. Thank God for his mercy. If you have a comment or question, did you? Thank God for his mercy. Did you notice what David said to the priest? He said, the priest comes out and he's scared. The priest comes out and he's scared. He says, what are you doing here? And David says, I'm on a mission from the king. True or false? Big fat lie.
Yeah, I'm quibble about that a little bit. I'm on a mission
from the king. Right, okay. Yes. All right. Let's back up. Hold on, hold on, hold on. We'll back up. We'll back up to what he tells Jonathan. Jonathan, your dad's trying to kill me. Jonathan says, no, he's not. You're nuts. And he says, yes, I am. And here's how we'll prove it. I'm not going to go to dinner tomorrow. Instead, you go in and you tell that I am with my brothers. Was he with his brothers? No. So, I like you. Yes, you can't quibble with the... Okay, David's a liar. No, he doesn't do it all the time. I'm overstating. David's a big fat liar. He tells some big fat lies. Why doesn't God zap him right there? Because God's merciful. Don't we all rely on that? I've told some lies.
Why didn't God take Saul out immediately?
I got a question for you. Who in here gardens or farms? You guys garden or farm? You're in Texas, you know about ranches. So, you're not in Texas, but... All right. You tell your child, you tell your son, "Son, I want you to go out there," and it's fall, right before the harvest, "I want you to go out there to that area over there that's never been cleared, and clear it so that we can plant there next year." Your son looks at you, right in the eye, and he doesn't do that. Instead, he goes and he burns down all of your crops. What are you going to do to your son? To put it mildly.
Yeah.
Saul was told by God, "You see those Amalekites? Kill them all and wipe out everything that they have." Did he do it? No. He comes to the priests at Nob. And what does he do to their city? Exactly what he was supposed to do, the Amalekites. Everything they have is destroyed, all their animals, the priests, men, women, and children. All dead. He looked at God. He could have done it with Amalek. That was him looking at God and saying, "No, God, I'm not going to do what you told me to do. And I'm going to do this over here." The worst thing he could possibly do. And God doesn't. I asked a minute ago, "What would you do?" I shudder the thought. I'm not going to think about it. But God didn't. Because his ways are higher than our ways. That's the context of Isaiah 55. Thank God for his mercy. Comments or questions, let me know. It's never wrong to do right. Yeah. So David eats. What did David eat? Was David supposed to?
No.
Not according to the law. All right. So in Matthew 12, this is referred to. Jesus himself refers to it. Matthew 12, verse 1. "At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads of grain and to eat. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, 'Look, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath.' And he said to them," several things. The first of all is, "Have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions? How he entered the house of God, they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but for the priests alone." Okay. Either he's doing at least one of two things, maybe a third, but at least one of two things. The first thing he may be doing here is saying, "Look, what David did is wrong. Do any of you accuse David?" And they would say, "Oh no, he's David. We don't go around him." In which case he could say, "You're being inconsistent. When David breaks a rule, you don't point him out. But when we break a rule, you do point him out." That might be it. I don't think that's what's going on at all. If it was what's going on, that would be valid enough. Or what he's saying to them is, let's go on and read. Verse 5. "Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? But I say to you that something greater than the temple is here. But if you had known what this means, 'I desire compassion and not a sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent." Okay, I don't think he's saying you're being inconsistent. What I think he's saying is you have totally missed the entire point of the law of Moses, which we know is true. They had missed the point. Matthew 23:23, "You tithe mint, dill, and cumin." You've got that down perfect. But when it comes to the weightier matters of the law, you've missed it. I think he's saying the same thing here. Was David guilty? Jesus here says that they did what was not lawful to do. But he also says that the priests break the Sabbath. Do the priests break the Sabbath? No.
He turned their reasoning around on
that. He's speaking accommodatively.
Like you guys, you're not making sense here.
Right. Exactly. And verse 1, they're picking the heads of grain, which Deuteronomy 23 allows for. If you have a footnote, that'll point you back there. They have a footnote for that. That's why he says in verse 7, you would not have condemned the innocent. They weren't breaking the law. The priests weren't breaking the law. I suspect David was not breaking the law either, and he's just using that language accommodatingly. How not? 1 Samuel 22. Remember the son, the Doeg, the Edomite? Verse 9. He reports to Saul, who was standing by the servants of Saul, and he said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, to the son of Ahitub. He, this is Ahimelech, inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath. And then, in fact, it'll say it again. Ahimelech will say in verse 14, verse 15, did I just begin to inquire for him today? In other words, David shows up, and according to Doeg's witness, he first prayed, and then he gave him stuff. Now, David is not supposed to, because he's not a priest, eat the showbread. But he walks away from there having eaten the showbread. If Ahimelech had given it to him, and it was sinful for him to do, what would Ahimelech been? An accomplice, right? So maybe he did. Maybe he broke the law. Maybe Ahimelech was an accomplice. But in this, we see that David shows up, Ahimelech prays, and Ahimelech then gives him the stuff. My point is, maybe God said to him, go ahead and give him the showbread this time. I don't know if that's true. But neither do I know for 100% certain that David actually broke the law. So we can't make a point either way, is what I'm saying. Does that make sense? Some sense? You don't have to agree with me. We got some weird looks going on. Did you understand what I said?
Yeah, I wouldn't repeat it to anyone who disagreed with me.
Well,
I just think it's an awfully weak. Yeah.
Okay. So what would you say?
I would have said he did the wrong thing.
But you can't prove it.
I think Jesus is saying there that David is doing the wrong thing.
You think?
Yeah.
You can't prove it.
No, but you're postulating something completely different that's not even mentioned there to find a way out. I mean, yes, he's praying, but then God told him otherwise. I mean, we never go there. We always try to avoid that.
We?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't. So, the whole point is this. You cannot prove anything either way.
I'm not sure what you're trying to be proved actually anyway. But
a contradiction. David did what was wrong and Jesus condones it. Situational ethics.
Yeah. Is the showbread, when it's removed, doesn't it become the property of the priest?
Yes, the priest only is to eat it.
But it's the property of the priest can give it away.
But he can only give it to his family.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, Jesus is making a point here at the end. He's making a point. I desire mercy.
Right.
I desire mercy. Ahimelech, praying to God, had mercy on David.
Yes, which is
giving him the bread, because he had nothing to eat.
Right.
So, there you go with that trying to prove,
Right, and this passage is used to prove situational ethics. Look, David shouldn't have had that, and so you can just write off the law when anything comes into play where you have a situation where something mercifully should be done, or there's the law to be followed. They broke the law so that David could have something mercifully. So it's okay to break the law whenever you have some mercy involved. That's the argument that people make. Okay. Well, right. But you have to be prepared to say, or at least it's helpful to be prepared to say why you couldn't go that far. And I'm suggesting that you can't prove anything either way from this. We can continue that. Okay, we'll call it a night. You always do the right thing. So Miss Billy used to say, she's passed on recently, her children would call her up, her two daughters, and say, Mommy, Mommy, my husband is, and then doing something wrong. And Miss Millie would say something like, well, I'm sorry that your husband is doing something wrong, but I don't want to hear about what your husband is doing. You do the right thing. When David spared the folks at Keilah, he said, God, should I go down there and spare them? And God said, yes, and go. So he went, and he spared them. And the next thing you know, what are they doing back to David? They're going to turn David over back to Saul. That's in chapter 20. The very people that he just went and saved.
Nice guys, huh?
Yes, they're stabbing. They turn around and they stab him right in the back. If David had known that, what they were going to do, should he have saved them anyway?
Yes, because God told him to.
You remember somebody who didn't when he knew what was going to happen? Basically knew what was going to happen? Jonah. I want you to go over there and save those people. Jonah, Jonah, what are you doing in that boat? Right. So yes, exactly. Never let the seemingly obvious, because we never know anyways, but we wouldn't say they're just obvious. There are obvious consequences. If you do this, this will happen. Well, don't let it stop you from doing what is right. Never, ever let that stop you. Okay. Comments or questions? We've almost gone a whole hour. Okay, we'll pick up more next week. Thanks for your work. Ethan has songs.